Tonight on Arena, we remember Christy Dignam of Aslan, who died earlier today. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, indeed, very sad news in the world of music this afternoon, as Christy Dignam, lead singer of Aslan, has died at the age of 63. Growing up in Finglas in North Dublin, Christy formed Aslan in 1982 alongside Alan Downey, Joe Jewell and Billy McGuinness. Their first album, Feel No Shame, came in 1988 and was one of the defining Irish albums of that period in music. 10 years ago, in 2013, Christy was diagnosed with an incurable blood cancer and has been fighting the disease with extensive treatments over the last decade. In a statement this afternoon, Christy's daughter, Ciara Dignam, said, "On behalf of my family, it is with a broken heart that we convey the news of my father's passing, Christy Dignam." She continued, "Let us all hold him in our hearts and cherish the remarkable life of a talented singer, great storyteller, and an amazing person." Joining me on the line right now is Gerry Fish and Tom Dunn. And I'll come to you first on this, Gerry. I heard this news myself this afternoon, and everybody I mentioned to just went, there was an immediate air of sadness about the loss of this. I think people had really in recent years taken Christy into their hearts. It's a difficult day, Gerry.
Yes, of course, and I'd like to pass on our condolences to Catherine and Ciara and Darren and all the family. Although we knew it was coming, I guess we're all a little shocked, you know, it's a little there. And I would go back a long way with Christy. I know him since probably 1984 or something, before they were even in Aslan, you know, they were in a band called Miller 18. So I'm both North Sider. So he's a working class hero, that's all I can say, really. He was just magic man.
And Tom Dunn, I suppose, in your case, something similar, a sense of shock, despite the fact, Tom, we all knew this was coming, as did Christy himself and his family, but it doesn't make it any easier today, does it?
No, it doesn't. I think the words of the wind, really, I feel like the wind was kind of knocked out of me when I heard the news. Even though we'd known, even though I'd followed the various media stories and the interviews he did with Ryan Tuberty, and you knew the writing was on the wall, but still, when I heard the news, it's just awful. He's one of the voices of our generation. When you think of all the singers of the days from, you know, Fela 90 and all that kind of era of great Irish bands, he's one of the defining voices of that, and one of the most distinctive voices. And as you know, Gerard, say, one of the nicest people you'd meet, an incredible messer, it has to be said, really, all of Aslan are, and aware. That was part of getting to know them. There was a divilment about them, which you had to be very, very wary of.
I'm glad that, because I was very keen that, of course, this is a very sad day, but when you think of Christy Dignam, I interviewed him a couple of times, and all I can remember is this smiling face looking out at you, and you got a sense of, this was a life that was fully lived and a lot of fun was had. Yes, there were difficulties and challenges along the way, but a lot of fun was had along the way as well. Gerry, that period, that kind of late 80s, 90s, that period in Irish music, it was a very productive period, it has to be said. And you and Tom and indeed Christy, all three of you and others, at the very heart of it. How would you define what was going on at that time, Gerry?
Well, I think Dublin was much smaller town, you know, wherever you went, you bump into someone, and everybody was in a band, everybody seemed to be in a band, and everybody chasing the record deal. So I think Aslan were one of the first, actually, they signed to EMI, so we were all chasing that stardom, I guess, and a way out of the situations we had in the 80s, but now you look back at them, and we were actually quite privileged, you know, to kind of have that outlet, you know, it was wonderful, and you know, It is devastating, really, to kind of think, you know, that we've lost somebody so special. And I guess at least we realised how special he was during his lifetime. And I think Aslan as well also showed people how hard a band work, and that it's a kind of it's a proper job, you know. We actually, you know, so that they're a very hard working band, great bunch of guys.
And you would have had the same experience, I suppose, Tom Dunn, as part of Something Happens. And Something Happens in Aslan, you would have met regularly, I presume, on the road or on your way to and from various places.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I think what echoing what Jerry was saying, we were the generation that formed bands. You know, you think back to what other generations had to go through, whether, you know, if you were born in 1914, you were the generation that went over the top. But we were the generation that got to form bands and go on the road. A very privileged position to be in. And yeah, our paths met many times. I remember once in London, we were kind of formally introduced to Aslan over at the breakfast table in the Clubby Hotel, which is one of the most famous rock and roll hotels in the world. And we'd been, you know, skirting around each other, we'd never really met. And it felt like the Yalta conference or something, the way we were sitting opposite each other at the table. But they'd had a very poor review in the Enemy, because the Enemy at the time wasn't very pro-Irish, you know, called a spade a spade. And I remember he was skirting around what they'd said. Finally, Billy wrote in and gave the exact line that the Enemy had said, which I couldn't repeat on the radio, but it was hilarious.
Yeah, Billy McGuinness, of course, you're talking about that. I can't imagine a formal introduction with Christy Dignam, but was that the nature of the beast? Was it slightly standoffish, Tom?
I think that we'd support them. You know, Something Happens had supported them in the Knockaway George Street venue, where they'd had a drum riser and the ego ramps, which we weren't allowed to use. So maybe they kind of felt like, you know, oh God, Jesus, they're signed now as well. We better start, you know, treat them as equals or something. there was this kind of slow reaching out. And then we got to know them really well. God, our paths seemed to never stop crossing. After that, I think they were probably the band we knew best in Dublin.
Yeah.
And the band we were most fearful of in Dublin as well.
Yeah, and I say you weren't alone in that particular emotion of, because they were such a strong band. They're the one maybe that many people looked up to. Jerry, maybe you'd lead us in. Let's hear some of that wonderful voice. It's the minute you hear it, you know it. Tell us a little bit about the song This Is, which I think particularly stands out for you, Jerry.
It does, because I think, you know, it's social commentary, and I think it's still happening today. There's people being ignored and people living on the edges of society. And I think Christy was he's a very down-to-earth man. You know, he talked to anybody, and, you know, you could hear where his passions were in this song. It's fantastic.
These are the hands of a tired man. This is the old man's trial. These are the eyes of a blood-crazed tiger staring at the maddening crowd. Can you stop, you look, you're searching for the meaning aloud.
The unmistakable voice there of Christy Dignam, and that's the song This Is. And with me this evening, mourning the passing of Christy Dignam, but also celebrating the divilment that was involved in that life as well, Tom Dunn, Jerry Fish, and joining us now, Pat Carty. Pat, I'm looking at a text here that has come in. I had the pleasure of meeting Christy years ago when my husband supported them. He was funny, kind, bold as brass, and full of divilment, but a gentleman through and through. Condolences to his family and bandmates, and I'd say that I think there's a lot of the sentiment that's going on around the country this evening. He was the first superstar, first rock star you met, Pat?
That's correct. In a place called Shinron, which is somewhere outside Burr in the 1980s, around 1988. So Feel No Shame, the album that song is on, had just come out and they were going around promoting it. So I hitchhiked over with my girlfriend from Tullamore, where I was living. I was down the front, singing every line. Outside afterwards, Christy comes out. I go over to say hello. And he just couldn't have been nicer. He was telling a story about, I think they were in trouble in Disneyland or something. It was in the Sunday World at the time. Fans might remember that. And he was just great. He looked the part as well. That's the other thing as well. No disrespect to Tom or Jerry there, but Christy was a beautiful looking man. You know, and he had the leather jacket. And, you know, and they had... They just had, as you were saying there, that it was, Tom was talking about people going over the top. I was part of the generation that was down the front. So I was lucky enough to get to see all those bands at that time. And Aslan were just amazing. It was just his voice, you know, no disrespect to the other lads in the band, but the voice. And he wrote, you know, a song like This Is, talking about that there, an anthem like that. Like, all bands write songs, but writing an anthem. And then they came back when everybody had written them off, and did it again with Crazy World, you know? Yeah. And it's just phenomenal, really.
In fact, that song, This Is, Pat Carty saying he sang every note and sang every word. He did not sing every note, as you will probably attest to, Tom. Try singing This Is, or just try singing many of the Christy Dignam songs. There's quite a range, isn't there, in terms of...
I had a good range, Sean.
not an easy thing at all. I once, there was another friend of ours, sadly, I thought I'd go past Fitzpatrick, who was the piano player in both Aslan and Something Happens at the time. So we were at his funeral, and I think the band were worried about Christy's voice because he was sick at that time. So they were saying, would you just do This Is, you know? So I very foolishly said, yeah, no problem. I can have that, you know. So we went along. Christy was there, and then when we started singing, it became obvious I did not have it covered in quite the range that I thought I did. And Christy jumped in to start singing, and he had his arm around me, and I was singing and looking at him, and that close, marveling at the power of it and the control in his voice and the emotion in his voice and all those things that were just coming so naturally to him that you might listen to and think is easy, but when you go and try and do it, that's when your eyes kind of get open.
Well, isn't that the trick, really, to make it look easy? And I suppose, I believe part of the party trick for him was to sing for his wife Catherine, so she got these, she was serenaded in those very high tenor notes on a regular basis.
That was his trick. I met them both at a gig in Dublin, the one for when he was very ill, and they were telling me stories of growing up. And Christy's gift was singing. And it was there from when he was 7, 8, or 9. And then people would stop and say, sing. And to impress Catherine when he was trying to get off in the really early days, he'd sing to her in the fields in singlet. And she loved it.
Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't?
Yes. I think that, you know, they were together their whole lives. They're a lovely couple. I always loved meeting them.
Yeah, Catherine, and I'm sure Catherine in particular is heartbroken this evening, and as indeed are the children, as you said. But back in 2013, of course, we had that big night for Christy, Gerry. That was, when you think of the people who were there to support Christy when that diagnosis had come through, Danny O'Reilly of the Coronas, Brezzy, Paul Brady, Shane McGowan, Mary Black, Don Meskell, Tom was there, yourself, Gerry, Steve Wall, and the list goes on and on. I mean, I could be reading for a half an hour. It was a huge show of support and love for Gerry, or for Christy, I beg your pardon.
Christy, yeah, of course. But I was lucky enough to duet. We did, I think they recorded as well, Rock and Roll Suicide, David. He's a big David Bowie fan. So I loved singing with Christy, but it wasn't just his singing. The way he performed with his hands was quite magical. You know, he's very, very unique. But that night in particular, I know, because as I said, I know the guy since the early 80s and we're good old mates and good muckers, you know. And I didn't think he'd see the week out. So I think everybody thought I'd never seen a sicker person, to be honest. So I guess he got 10 years from that time, you know, so that was quite a blessing, I suppose, in itself, because what a fighter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what a fighter. Absolutely that. And Pat Carty, the success that Aslan had, did they achieve, do you think, what they deserved? And did Christy achieve the adulation and the success that he deserved, Pat?
Well, certainly in this country, you know, you're talking about, I think there was 5 number one albums, and say something like Live in Dublin, you know, I was at one of those nights in Vicar Street back in 1999. And then the same year they played The Point, you know, and then went back and played it again the following year. Outside of Ireland, maybe not, but sure. You know, ask Paul Cleary, ask Whipping Boy. Sometimes greatness has to be enough on its own, you know, and they certainly were that, I think, you know, a couple of times. Just an amazing performer. I mean, I don't know if you mentioned it already. You remember doing Green Fields of France on the Late Late, you know, when he just knocked the whole country onto its backside, you know, that was just amazing. Just the voice was incredible.
Yeah, were you going to say something there, Tom, or was it Gerry? I don't know who was coming.
I think a thing that where you talk about their success, they were taken into the heart of this country in a way that would have been their dream when they were setting out to get the life they got, to get the longevity they got, to get to do what they loved doing for as long as they did. That was what they set out to do, and I think it's probably more than they hoped for, really, because that was incredible success. And to become such a part of the fabric of the country, that's an incredible achievement. It really is. And I think they valued it and they loved it, and that was worth more to them, I think, than international success or something in America or something. But what they had here was sensational.
Gerry?
I think they worked really hard to kind of for their fans. They were definitely a fan band, you know, and they opened up a circuit for many of us, you know. So, I mean, Dublin used to have three gigs. It was the Ivy Rooms, the Baggerin and the McGonagall's, you know. I think the Ivy Rooms is Fit the McGee, you know, the other two are gone. So from that small kind of town and those small gigs, you know, they opened up a massive circuit. They went out and found their fans. They played everywhere. So I think they built that up and they worked on that. So hard, you know.
How will you remember Christy Pat Carthy, first of all?
Just as the voice. I tell you, he was doing an interview with Hot Press, and this is a while back, you know, and it was he was asked how he'd like to be remembered. This is a while back, and he said, as a singer and songwriter in Ireland who helped elevate the quality of music in some small way, if I got that, he said, I'd be happy enough. Yeah. And I would just add to that that there was nothing small about Christy Dignam at all.
Yeah, and Tom, I guess that is what he has given us. Tom Dunn?
Yeah, I'd go with that voice again. I just, you know, I watched the Greenfield of France video today as well, and what it brought to the songs was just this incredible humanity. It was really such a strong, amazing... It reminded me of Johnny Cash at times. He brought things to songs you didn't know were there.
Yeah,
And that's some gift.
And finally, I'll come to you, Jerry Fish.
Well, I think I would have considered Christy a friend, but I think he's a friend of everybody in the country. I think he just had that down-to-earth, sincere love of people. And I think that's what's maybe breaking our hearts tonight, you know.
It is, for sure. But also, you know, it was that openness and great serenity that he expressed sometimes in some of the interviews that he gave over the past 10 years, which can't have been easy interviews to give and to talk about. And I'll finish up with two things. The great song, Crazy World, I think we have to go out on that. But before we go to that, let us hear Christy in an interview with Ryan Troubridy on the show here on RT Radio 1, which was broadcast, believe it or not, in April of this year.
I believe I'm spiritual. I believe we're all spiritual beings, you know, in some sense or other. So I remember there used to be an old saying when I was going to NA that religion is for people who want to go to heaven. Spirituality is for people who've been to hell. And I really identified with that, you know.
Voice there of Christy Dignam, and of course Crazy World. My thanks to Jerry Fish, Tom Dunn and Pat Carthy for helping us to remember the joy that was Christy Dignam. Christy's death was announced today. He was in his 60s, and his death was announced by his family earlier this afternoon. Seven on Tuesday night's Arena. Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror always finds a tantalising twist on the modern world. Consistent themes of loneliness, life and death and the growing encroachment of technology imbue the work, but the show always finds new ways to treat them. In series 6 of Black Mirror, which drops this week on Netflix, a woman finds her fairly ordinary life dramatised on television. A couple find a juicier story when they head to picturesque Scotland to make a nature documentary. And the less we tell you about the episode Beyond the Sea, the better. That one is directed by Irishman John Crowley and it features a starry cast, including, this is the overall series, including names like Selma Hayek, Josh Hartnett, Aaron Paul and Annie Murphy. Earlier today, I spoke with the writer of Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker, and the executive producer of the show, Jessica Rhodes. Before we hear from them, let's hear a clip from one of this new batch of standalone episodes. It's called Loch Henry, and in it, a couple, Davis and Pia, return to his hometown to make a nature documentary. But there's far more interesting true crime story, to be told. In this scene, Davis, played by Samuel Blenken, his friend, played by Daniel Portman, And are there with an outsider called Mayalala, played by Mayalala Harold, and this is a character called Pia. She's all worried about the local tourist industry. She doesn't understand why it's not doing well, but they are going to tell her about a notorious local man called Ian Adair.
I don't get it. It's so beautiful around here. How are you not overrun with tourists?
Because of Ian Adair.
Who is Ian Adair?
You didn't tell her about Ian Adair?
Come on. It's a
Who
bit...
is Ian Adair?
Okay. Fine. So, Ian Adair was a guy. He lived up at Five Acres Farm on the hill there with his mum and dad. People said he was quiet, easily led, not too bright, all of that, you know. But really, he was just some local guy. Anyway.
Turned out he tortured and killed people.
It's building up to that.
I haven't got your storytelling instincts. You tell it.
No, you spoke of it now.
No, not the end bit with your dad.
What end bit with your dad?
Can I just start from the beginning?
Yeah, just you pretend you don't know the murder stuff yet.
Sure.
Okay.
Samuel Blenken, Daniel Portman and Mayalala Harold there in a scene from Loch Henry, one of the episodes in the new season of Black Mirror. Joanne Rhodes and Charlie Brooker spoke to me earlier on, she being the executive director, he being the creator and writer. I began by asking Charlie how audience expectation of the unexpected affected his approach to this new season.
I think the thing to do was to sort of upend the apple cart, so to speak. Which is usually a negative thing, isn't it? Was to sort of cast out my assumptions of what the show was and start. So I sort of started almost from a pure horror perspective this time around. And then so the episodes are actually in reverse order to the order they were written and shot. And then they got gradually more trad mirror in a way as they went along. So that was one of the things, was to sort of rip up the rule book a bit. And it keeps it fresh and interesting for yourself. So you have to sort of ignore what you're being told Black Mirror is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I guess people who love Black Mirror want to see Black Mirror when they put Black Mirror on. And yet you have to please them and please yourself. Where's the balance?
Please them, please yourself. And also, like, what people want, I guess, when they put Black Mirror on, one of the things they want is to be surprised.
Yeah.
And so it's quite difficult to keep. You can't keep doing the same episodes and the same stories over and over again, because that becomes, it reminds me of when we first went from Channel 4 to Netflix. Up until that point, every single episode had been a real downer at the end. Spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen seasons 1 and 2. And so the first one I wrote when we were going to Netflix was San Junipero, to see what happens if I wrote a hopeful and uplifting story. And it refreshed the whole thing for me. Mm. So again, I was sort of doing that. I was just thinking, I don't want to fall into the trap of writing what other people think a Black Mirror episode is.
As an executive producer, Jessica, how much do you sweat when you hear, I'm changing everything, I'm throwing out the rule book, Jessica? The rule book, Jessica.
Well, I think when Charlie and I first started talking about this season, he had already been really reinvigorated by tossing the rule book. And so I got to see him really enthusiastic, not only about the episodes he had just finished writing, but it really kind of set a tone heading into the back half of the season and continuing to write. And that's the best feeling, to see a writer really enthusiastic about what's about to be shot, but also about what they're heading into with a blank page.
Technology is
page. That's the most terrifying two words in the world.
Well, you did quite well filling up those blank pages on this one, I think, Charlie, it's safe to say. The technology is certainly a theme that is there in Black Mirror, and definitely there very much to the fore in episode 1, Joan is Awful. Who are your targets here, Charlie?
Well, I mean, I'd been thinking about it. Came about because I was looking at the couple of ideas I'd been toying around with that I couldn't quite work out what to do with. And then I was watching The Dropout, which was a show about Elizabeth Holmes, as a dramatization of the Theranos sort of scandal. And I was struck by, there has been a vogue for prestige drama, sort of almost reenactments of things that just happened. And there was that thing with, you remember, there was the thing with Kenneth Branagh playing Boris Johnson, like about his handling of the pandemic, which felt like it was almost overlapping with the actual reality that was still unfolding. And so that sort of came out of that. So that was the sort of starting point in a way. And then that feeds into once you've got that, it feeds into the other, one of the other ideas I've been thinking about, which was to do with like AI generated imagery and sort of stuff like that. That's, and so suddenly you've got this like comic story that can comment on a lot of things. So it wasn't necessarily one thing, but it was certainly came out of a funny idea.
Let's listen to a clip featuring Annie Murphy as Joan and Avi Nash as her fiance. She's come home from work. She's just fired somebody. She has a disturbing text coming through from an old boyfriend. And they sit down to watch, believe it or not, a platform called Streamberry.
What do you want to watch?
Oh, I'm easy.
Let's see what's on Streamberry.
All right. Oh, how about Sea of Tranquility?
Eric said it blows.
Oh, well, if Eric said it blows.
Okay. Lock Henry, the Scottish murder thing?
I can't really do another true crime. I'm sorry, just okay, after Gacy.
What about...
oh my God. What?
New drama, Joan is awful. Is that Selma Hayek?
She even has your hair.
That's not my hair.
Well, it's a lot like your hair. And she's even called Joan.
Okay, what even is this show?
No clue, but, well, we're watching it.
No, we're not watching Joan is awful, whatever the hell it is.
Just hit play. Come on. Hit play.
Annie Murphy and Avi Nash in a scene there from the first episode of the new season of Black Mirror. Charlie Brooker, that sounds very like Netflix Streamberry. That looks very like Netflix Streamberry. How did you pitch that one?
Don't tell them. Don't tell them it looks like Netflix. They haven't seen it yet. No, okay. We asked.
Yeah. We just thought it would be fun. We had the idea of the ribbon first, stealing their logo. So we asked, I guess.
An homage.
And then they said yes. And so we had the idea to ask for the ta-dum. And once they said yes to that, I mean, we just kind of went for broke. And it all followed after that. They've been lovely partners. And they have a real sense of humor.
It
would be great to be able to say, they didn't want us to do it, but we're so anarchic and rebellious, we just demanded, and we broke them. But no, they agreed really quickly.
And how quickly
did... ask again and again. Yeah. I was pretty nervous they changed their mind.
Yeah. So how quickly did you get Selma Hayek on board to make fun of herself? She has great fun in this series.
She's fantastic. Not only did she got it straight away, but so the original version of the script that she saw, obviously, so it's not too big, I don't know quite when this goes out, but it's not too big a spoiler to say she plays herself as well in this episode. So so obviously the first version of that I'd sent to her didn't have some of the more outrageous lines of dialogue and stuff like this that she's saying in the finished episode, because I was a bit nervous, right? You want her to be in it. You don't want to accidentally offend her or drive her away. But the first thing she said, we had a Zoom call with her, which was one of the most entertaining Zoom calls I've ever had, because she's hilarious. And she encouraged me specifically to make it more outrageous. She said, you can say this. Why don't I say this? And she had lots of really,
really personal ideas.
There's a couple of bad libs from her that are in there. She's just very funny. Encouraging it to, she was, turn it up to 11.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long du golf clair.
Excuse me.
Oyster would say that too.
Excuse me, sir. I apologize for the intrusion, but you're David Ross?
I believe I am.
It's an honor to meet you, sir.
Oh my God, such an honor.
Thank you, you're too kind.
You are so real. It's incredible.
May I? Oh my God, it's amazing. So up there, are you like sleeping right now?
It's a kind of sleep. The human experience, the survival of the human body, of life, that's really central to the mission. Anyway, we have to be.
So great to meet you.
So great. I know they're excited, but sometimes they are so goddamn rude.
Oh, they don't realize, honey.
You'll forgive me if I'm a little bit parochial on my final discussion with you, which is the episode directed by John Crowley, Irish director, of course, Beyond the Sea. I think this was quite a collaborative process, this whole one, Charlie, more so maybe than some of the other episodes. Am I right?
I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily more so than others, in that, but certainly, like every director is very different, and John is like, he's got this theatrical background as well. He's like a very, very, very sort of thoughtful guy, and he. It was interesting in that, like all directors ask questions when you give them the script, and he asked very sort of very, very well considered specific questions about very specific. Very specific, that's what I remember, very specific sort of moments in the script. And I found myself naturally, because he's so nice and gentle and wise and calming, but I slightly felt, my initial reaction was to feel a bit guilty, like, I don't know the answer to this. But then what you do is you, through the discussion, you talk about it and you end up fleshing out parts of the script, changing things, this, that, and the other. And you just end up with a much better story at the end of the day, which is great selfishly, because it makes me look more clever, like I thought of that in draft one, which I hadn't. And it's just always, that's the best way to work is, and that's across the board with sort of all of them. The directors come on, they bring also that, you know, their own viewpoint, their own personality, their own questions. And so they hugely shape what's going on, and then that process happens again once you get your cast in place. And so there was a fantastic experience. He's done it, and you know, that episode, he's done an astonishing job on it. Some tough stuff in that, and he pulled it off.
La mer. La Mer, some of the music that is used in episode 3 of the new season of Black Mirror, Beyond the Sea, the title of that episode, and it is directed by John Crowley. Really interesting episode indeed, as Charlie Brooker and Jessica Rhodes were talking to us about Black Mirror before that. The new season, season 6 of Black Mirror, starts on this Thursday, the 15th of June, on Netflix. It's the 21st of June, the longest day of the year, and it's Dublin. Soon everyone in the flats will be gathering for a solstice bonfire, but Ivor wants to die. He is terminally ill and he has hired a doctor, Maria, to come and help. His friend Leon, however, has other ideas. He is determined to give Ivor one last great day out. So begins Sunlight, debut feature from Claire Dix, a director you may know from her documentaries and short films up to now. But this is, as I said, her debut feature. Ivor is played by Liam Kearney, Leon by Barry Ward, and Maria by Maureen Beattie. Delighted that Claire Dix is with me in studio this evening. It deals with the whole idea, really, the film of assisted dying. It's a very important topic in the film. Was that a starting point for you, Claire? Was it a theme you wanted to tackle in some way?
Well, actually, myself and Alva Keoghan, the writer, and Roisin Geraghty, the producer, and Barry Ward, actually, who stars in the film, have made a short film called Take Me Swimming in 2017. It was shortly after Alva's mother had passed away, actually. So this was very much, this theme of death and actually choosing the time of your own exit was very much on Alva's mind. And after we made that film, she really wanted, there was more she said she wanted to do around that theme. There was more to explore. But we knew we didn't want to make a feature about a weighty topic like that. You know, with, I know Take Me Swimming kind of was a bit more serious. We felt, you know what, if we're going to do a film about this topic, then there has to be light with the dark. So really this film is about a friendship, love, a very lovely friendship between Ivor and Leon. And even though that theme is very much embedded in the film, I think actually what more comes to the fore is this lovely friendship between these two men.
And again, the nature of that friendship is because of, if you like, a life that Ivor, who's the Liam Kearney character, the man who is dying in the story, the life that he has given to Barry Ward's character, the character of Leon, who previous to this was addicted to heroin And Leon was his sponsor who got him out of that. It's a lovely twist and a turn, the kind of mirror images of each other in some ways, aren't they?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the film is set over one day. The very last scene is like a separate day, but the guts of the film is one day. So I suppose the trick as well was to give the backstories of these characters, you know, because you can't show them. It's kind of more insinuated and you're learning as you go along. And as you're kind of with these characters, you're learning about the backstory. So you learn that actually Ivor, as Leon put it, saved his life. So he became a sponsor. He really helped him turn his life around. And then now Leon is faced with this decision. Am I going to help my best friend actually end his life?
Yeah. And he really doesn't. He's not in favour of this at all, as we do. I want to listen to a clip which gives us a real sense of just how annoyed he is that Ivor would even be thinking this. Because in the meantime, Leon, the Barry Ward character, has become the carer for the very ill Ivor. And he goes to the flat to see him. Ivor's there with a doctor attempting to help him to end his life. So Liam Kearney as Ivor here, Barry Ward as Leon.
Leon, what about the stables?
I can't do it.
What about the lads?
I can't do any of it anymore.
It's not fair.
It's not fair on you. I need 24-hour care.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. I mean, I'll do it with a heart and a half.
I know. That's why...
We'll get you another nurse. A hot one.
I don't want another nurse. I don't want a stupid motorised bed. Leon... I don't want to be in hospital.
But you're over the great, man. You're over the Viking.
I want to go now.
Not now, Ivor. Just not now, like, right? Not now. Yeah, just not now.
But it has to be now. Because I can still hit the switch now.
What about courage? Truth. See you tomorrow, you said.
Stop, Leon.
And that's Liam Kearney and as Ivor, Barry Ward as Leon in a scene there from Sunlight, a debut feature from Claire Dix, who's with me in studio this evening. And you get a sense of it there. There's a reference there to you're Ivor the Great, because he loves to dress up as a Viking. He seems to have done that kind of theme park activity at some point in his past, which gives a great visual aspect to the film as well.
Yeah, the idea is that he's a reconstructionalist, if that's a word. And he has stables and he has a whole troop of people. And the idea is that they would do this for films or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. And it also really ties into Ivor's, I think, his persona before he got sick, that he was this big, strong man, physically, mentally, you know. And so him being confined to a bed is just, he just can't accept that about himself. So even the fact they get him a wheelchair, and, you know, you can imagine, but when the wheelchair is all wrapped in plastic, it's been there for months in the hall, and he just has refused. I'm not going out. I don't want anyone to see. I don't identify as this. I don't want anyone to see me like this.
Barry Ward, who plays the character of Leon, you know, who has managed to recover from drug addiction and has now built a new life for himself. He's the executive producer on the film as well. So he was obviously very much part of the development of the work, was he?
Absolutely. So Barry was actually on board before the script was even written. Mm. So after Take Me Swimming, the short film I mentioned earlier, we all knew we wanted to work together again.
Yeah.
And Alva kind of pitched this idea, sort of nub of an idea to us. And we were like, yeah, brilliant. Sounds great. Go ahead. And to Barry, because I think for Alva, it helps her to have an actor in mind. Actually, you may not get that actor, but I think for her, writing with an actor in mind really, really helps bring that character alive. But we knew we had Barry.
Yeah. Well, if he's kind of executive produced the thing, he's probably going to be happy to be in it as well.
Yeah, so that was brilliant. And I know that really helped. And Barry was just so on board and such a collaborator from the very beginning.
And then Liam Kearney, I think, came on a bit later with big Viking beard on. I mean, we had to have time to grow that.
Absolutely,
but
another
person that I really wanted to mention, I mean, it's a fine cast. There are the stable Lydia McGuinness and the stable Erica Rowe is one of the women in the flats as well. Some great performances in there. But Maureen Beattie, who plays the part of the doctor, she's a Scottish doctor, as it turns out, in this, she brings a really interesting dynamic to the piece.
Yeah, she does. And Maureen was cast, I'd say, about 3 days before we filmed. So it was a bit nail-biting. But I actually can't imagine anyone else in the role.
Yeah, she's you super know,
yeah,
in it. Yeah.
Yeah, and even her accent, I don't even the Scottish. And she wasn't written, I think, originally, actually. And you know, it's funny, I can't even remember what it was originally now because she is Maria, you know. But I'm pretty sure that role was for, it was like an English accent in all her heads.
Yeah.
But when she, it was like, oh no, perfect Scottish. Yeah, that's just you know,
and you don't need any backstory. We get some backstory, but you don't need a reason for her to be in Ireland. She's just here. That's fine.
Absolutely.
You accept that. You don't. If you start explaining it, in fact, it probably becomes more of an issue. I'm glad you didn't start to explain it. Music is hugely important, and this has been important for you in the documentaries as much as it has as it is in this feature.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the role of music in the film overall, Claire.
Yeah. So Leon is a musician, but a very unschooled musician, and I think by the end of it, you're kind of thinking, is he good or is he terrible or there's some, maybe a tiny bit of talent. But I think maybe if he'd been born into maybe another family, he would have had the piano lessons and he would have, but he's from a, you know, deprived background and he's kind of had this little bit of talent that he has been, you know, kind of salvaging maybe a keyboard from here and there and made up instruments. And you see him at home at the beginning and he's kind of, you know, doodling around with stuff. But actually what was funny was Barry, so we got Seamus Fogarty to write the end piece for the film, and Barry and Seamus live on the same street in London, and we were supposed to film in 2020, but because of COVID and we got pushed by actually nearly a year, so Barry and Seamus had a year to write that song, and now they have an album's worth of music and a Christmas hit and everything.
Yeah.
So that music then, we would have given that music to Stephen Shannon and Matthew Nolan, who are composers, and that was their inspiration for the score.
One final thing I'd like to mention, actually I should have said as in the cast as well, Mark O'Halloran, who plays a lovely little cameo side role here as Craig's the kind of the drug dealer when Leon's finding is challenged with some of the things that he has to deal with, and will he slip or won't he slip as part of the plot. But the director of photography here, Narayan Van Mel, who also worked in the Oscar-winning short An Irish Goodbye, that was a nice get. What do you think Narayan brought to the table?
Oh, like I really wanted Narayan to shoot it from very early on because I'd worked with him in Broken Song, and I just knew that style that we wanted to film it in, a kind of a rough and ready style to kind of mirror Leon's energy and this kind of ping pong kind of nature that he has. And I knew Narayan could do that he could film it almost like a documentary, but find these beautiful frames, you know, almost by following somebody, you know. So he works really quickly and he just brought a lovely energy and dynamic kind of filming to it.
Big shift for you, was it, from, you know, the short to the feature, or from indeed the documentary world to the feature? What were the biggest challenges there for you?
Yeah, well, I had worked in shorts before documentary, actually, and then made the doc features and kind of moved into that. I think there's a similarity, really, in the way I was. I think we approached it almost like film, like shooting wise, we approached it like filming a doc almost, you know. We were very, very prepared. We were like, you know, we're going to react. So if something happens, we're just going to go with it and let's kind of.
It has that verite feel to it, almost as if, the you know, like a handheld camera, even though you're not doing that all the time, but it has that feel to it of a documentary.
Yeah, so Narayan lit it in such a way that the actors could actually move wherever they wanted in the room. So wherever they went would be right. Now, they were small sets. They were real houses, real flats, so they couldn't really go too far. But, you know, they had that freedom and it had loosened everything up. So I think that definitely, that was the doc background kind of influencing that style.
Influencing in it. Well, congratulations, Alan.
Thank you very much.
First one out of the way, onwards and upwards from here, says
indeed.
You. Claire, thanks for coming into
thanks,
us this evening. Sunlight, the title of Claire Dix's debut feature. It's released in selected cinemas in Ireland and the United Kingdom on this coming Friday. Since winning the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2013 for her a cappella piece, Partita for 8 Voices, Caroline Shaw has gone on to collaborate with musicians as wide-ranging as the Attacker Quartet, Kanye West, and she has written film scores and for the TV series such as Fleischman Is in Trouble. She will be coming to Ireland for the first time this weekend to take part in Louth Contemporary Music Society's festival, and I'm delighted to be joined by Caroline Shaw right now. Caroline, winning the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2013 for your composition Partita for 8 Voices. I think you were one of the youngest recipients of this prestigious award. A wonderful thing, I would have thought. What kind of pressure did it put on you, however, being the youngest recipient?
Oh, it was a surprise to me and to, I think, many people, my friends and family. But at the time, I hadn't written a lot of music. It was one of the first pieces I'd ever made. So there was not a lot of expectation. And I spent the last 10 years writing music kind of nonstop, so without fear.
Yeah, well, as I suppose it's a good start to a career, certainly, yeah, to get that. I know that you played violin, I think, for the most part. It was an instrument that you played from a very, very young age, in fact. But a lot of the music of yours that I've heard, certainly Partita for, as the title suggests, eight voices, the voice seems to be hugely important in terms of what you do, writing for voice.
I love writing for voice because it's the instrument that we all share. It's one of the first things that we do when we're born. And my mother is a singer, and I grew up singing in church choirs. And I love how it's using the voice as an instrument, sometimes without words, and finding all the different colors within it.
So the Partita for Eight Voices, then, you might give me some idea of how that piece is structured and what you were looking for in the composition.
I was trying to imagine certain sounds that I had never heard before but wanted to hear. It's in four parts. It's kind of structured like a really traditional Baroque suite, almost like Bach, but it sounds nothing like Bach. And there are mixes of speaking and sort of growling sounds and breath and wanting to kind of elevate the way that we use our voice every day in conversation, and what if that turned into music?
Right, well, let's have a listen to a little bit of the Courant, which would be one of the movements from a general Baroque suite, as you say. But in your case here, it is just for the eight voices. This is from Caroline Shaw's Partita for Eight Voices, the Courant. So just a little section there from the Courant movement from Caroline Shaw's Partita for Eight Voices. Caroline Shaw coming to Ireland this weekend for the Louth Contemporary Music Society's festival. And she's speaking with me on the line from Switzerland, I believe, in fact, this evening, Caroline. I was speaking with Rufus Wainwright in an interview that will be broadcasting later in the week. He has on his album Folkocracy, he has a Schubert song where it's only him singing, but it's several parts. Is that just you singing, or did you pull in a few other voices there as well? There sounds as if there's definitely a lower male voice in there.
Oh yeah, there we're eight singers as part of a group called Roomful of Teeth. I am voice three, but there are four high voices and four low voices.
And writing in that nature for the voice itself, you had to move beyond, I guess, just straightforward singing on an open vowel sound into those breath sounds and rhythmic sounds. How important was it for you to explore, I suppose, all those aspects of vocal music?
I love trying to think of, what the voice can do, and also how people around the world use their voice in expressive ways. And so finding kind of new rhythms and new colors and some of the things that we're not encouraged to do when in classical music, growls and using our throat in different ways.
Yeah, the presumption sometimes that it all has to be beautiful sound, that there can't be some other sounds in there as well. How did the collaboration with Kanye West come about? That's maybe not something that people in the classical music genre or area of music are used to.
Oh, yeah. It was, we don't work together anymore, but we there was a period of time where it was working better. And he came to a concert of Roomful of Teeth back a few years ago, and was kind of taken with the piece that I'd written and asked me to join on a couple of his albums. So he was at the time really curious about using the voice in different ways as well.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of that collaboration. And again, it's very much you and your music at the very top of this Say You Will track from Kanye West.
Now I'm awake, sleep is soon. Hey, 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 don't say you will unless you will. Hey, 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 don't say you will.
So I'm guessing, Caroline Shaw, that all of that vocal work around Kanye's voice is you and your group.
Yeah, that's actually just me. Many, many layers of
so
me.
So that is and you. That's a choir of a choir of Caroline Shaw.
I
got the impression when you said it was working better for a while. When did it kind of go west? What went wrong?
Oh, go west. I think that a few years ago, some public and political statements that he made that I and many people who worked with him strongly disagreed with, and I think there's some mental health issues maybe involved as well.
All right, so you decided it was time for you to move on. I loved some of the music in Fleischman Is in Trouble, which when I watched it, I did not know was your music, but I now know was your music. Claire Danes and Jesse Eisenberg, great thing to get involved with there. But you do things with the vocal music here that really reflect what's going on in the drama. Maybe I think I have a little section here where you kind of bend the pitches in some way. Maybe you'd explain to me what's going on.
Oh yeah, there's several different sections where, you know, the show presents characters that at first you really hate, and then you start to see kind of what's going on and the backstories. So we tried to color these scenes and characters with, you know, pointing to the complexity, or, you know, this idea that there's something underneath that you don't see just yet.
Yeah. Well, I'll finish up by listening to a piece of that. But can I ask, when you come to Ireland at the weekend, will the wonderfully named ensemble Room Full of Teeth, will you be taking a full room full of teeth with you?
Oh, no, I'm really lucky to get to work with a wonderful choir and a wonderful string quartet there. And I'm super honoured to be invited. It's my first time coming. I'm really excited.
Let it not be the last. And I'll finish up with a little bit of the music for Fleischman, Caroline. And I'll give people details of your particular performance after this. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
It goes there. That is some of Caroline Shaw's music for Fleischman Is in Trouble. And Caroline will be performing with the Esposito Quartet at the 2023 Louth Contemporary Music Society Festival in Dundalk on the 17th of June. Full details on louthcms.org. And just to finish up this evening, hi lads, Christy Smile would light up a room, an incredible voice, but gone too soon. I never met him, but I did. Touched so many hearts as he lifted the lid, with lyrics so pure and melody so strong as he delivered his words in every single song. Rest in peace, Christy. You were truly one of the greats, writes John Joe O'Donovan to us this evening on Arena. And that remembering, of course, Christy Dignam, who we celebrated at the beginning of tonight's programme. And that is our lot for this Tuesday here in Arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy Research. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.